Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Teneo Insights conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to our first presenter, Mr. Kevin Kajiwara. Please go ahead, sir.
Great. Thank you very much, David, and welcome everybody to today's Teneo Insights call. I'm Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's Political Risk Advisory business, and thank you for joining our latest weekly coronavirus-related call to talk about the outbreak itself, as well as the political and economic and corporate impacts of all of this. So joining me today, we will start, as usual, with an assessment of where we are and an update on the outbreak itself. And that conversation will be led by Dr. Bradley Connor. He is a senior advisor to Teneo. He is a clinical professor of medicine at the Weill Cornell Medical College, and he's also an attending physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital. He is the founder and the medical director of the New York Center for Travel and Tropical Medicine, and he is a consultant to the CDC. We'll then turn our attention to the latest developments in Washington at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. And joining me as usual are Orson Porter. He's a senior managing director for Teneo and the head of our Washington office. He leads our government affairs efforts. He was formerly the U.S. director of government and public affairs for Nike, and he served in the White House as a special assistant to President Bill Clinton. Tony Sayegh is also a managing director. He joined Teneo Strategy and Consulting following his tenure in the Trump administration, where he was assistant secretary of the Treasury, and he led the Office of Public Affairs for Secretary Steve Mnuchin. We're then today going to turn our attention to Europe for a couple of reasons. One, not least of which, is that we're starting to see some countries contemplate how they are going to restart their economies. We focused on this in China last week. We're going to talk to my colleague Karsten Nickel today. He's a managing director and one of the heads of research of our political risk advisory business, focusing on the UK and on Germany and on the EU institutions. And he has been posted with us in Berlin and Brussels and now in London. And finally, as we're in the in earnings season, we're joined by my colleague Christian Buss, who's joining us very early from the West Coast today. He's a senior managing director and the head of our investor relations practice, and prior to Teneo, he was the director of investor relations for Columbia Sportswear, and he had previously been a sell-side analyst in that space. At the conclusion of our prepared remarks today, there will be time for questions, so please think of what you might like to ask these gentlemen, and you'll be instructed how to enter the queue at that time. It's another day of major headlines, both on the virus as well as economically. Global cases yesterday hit 1.5 million, and that's notable in that it's only less than a week ago that we hit the 1 million mark. Also, another grim statistic will be that the U.S. should pass Italy today or this week for the country with the most fatalities. But I would also note that the United States has a population that's five times the size of Italy. So if you add up France, Italy, Germany, Spain, and the U.K., where you get roughly closer to the U.S. population, they've had a combined 52,000 deaths, and the U.S. is at about 15,000. The other major data point this morning just dropped a moment ago, and that's the latest initial jobless claims number, the third major jobless claims data point since the outbreak really hit the U.S. Workforce in force. The number was 6.6 million. And, you know, the International Labor Organization has also now predicted that in the second quarter, we will lose 6.7% of working hours globally. That's the equivalent of 195 million full-time workers. Stocks are mixed today on the last day of trading before the holiday, and other markets are watching the OPEC Plus and G20 energy and oil ministers meeting, to see if there's any agreement reached or talks of a 10 to 15 million barrel a day cut. But I would note that demand destruction is and remains at between 25 and 30 million. The U.S. government is contemplating what its next moves are going to be, both in terms of dealing with the outbreak as well as contemplating the restart of the economy, and Congress anticipating what a phase four or five or more fiscal packages could look like. China, we focused on last week, and we're going to continue to watch very closely. You know, Xi Jinping today indicated that they are seeing rising pressure from imported cases, and he is talking about long-term external uncertainty. They have closed the border with Russia today, and while schools are starting to reopen there, large-scale social events remain off-limits. So China is restarting in fits and starts. So let's turn to our speakers today, and I'd like to start with Dr. Connor, and perhaps you can give us an update on where you see things right now, and really where you see things going, contextualized with the administration's health officials and its economic advisors trying to develop the criterion for reopening.
Well, thank you, Kevin. So Kevin mentioned my role at the CDC. I'm the New York City site director for GeoSentinel, which is the Emerging Infectious Disease Network of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and I'm a consultant in their Division of Global Migration and Quarantine. So we've been through this before with SARS and with Ebola, but this is actually unprecedented. What I'd like to do is give you a little context behind the numbers, discuss the so-called flattening of the curve. I'd also like to discuss an approach to return to business, which I think I want to provide at least for the science and medical underpinnings of making decisions about return to work and reopening our population to going back to the workforce. We made terrible mistakes, not just the U.S., but globally in terms of the response to the pandemic. And our hope is we've learned from some of these mistakes. And when we reopen or return to work, that we don't make some of the same mistakes. So just a few words by the numbers. Kevin mentioned 1.5 million cases now globally. There will be 100,000 deaths by the end of this week. And as Kevin mentioned, 50% of these cases have occurred in the last 9 days. So this is significant. And when we talk about a trajectory or what we call an epicurve, these numbers are significant because they allow us to do some modeling. You know, in the U.S. now, almost 450,000 cases, 15,000 deaths. And this is occurring in 181 countries. So this is a true pandemic. And if we take any comfort in that, we realize that we're not alone, that this is a global problem that needs to be solved, not just locally, but globally as well. So let's talk about the numbers, because these are very significant numbers. Look at the New York numbers, for example, which I'm very close to. And if you look at the number of deaths and the number of cases in New York, for example, New York State, 150,000 cases, 7,000 deaths. You look at what we call a case fatality rate, and case fatality rates based on these numbers appear very high, over 3%, which we don't believe is really the case. We think that the number of cases is actually probably tenfold higher than what is being reported because of the large pool of asymptomatic positive patients or mildly symptomatic positive patients. Our colleagues in France, for example, in Paris, early on found that the districts in Paris, the arrondissements that had the highest rates of COVID-19 hospital admissions, they swabbed school children who were completely asymptomatic and found in those districts 50% of the school children were positive for COVID-19. So this pool of young children positive for the virus is a reservoir of infection. And until we do adequate testing and do some contact tracing, we're not going to get a true picture of what the scope of this is. So why hasn't that been done? Partly because of the lack of availability of point of care, what we call PCR tests, especially in the United States. This is something that would have been very valuable early on in stopping the spread or at least slowing it down. All right, so, you know, the R-naught or the doubling rate, you know, at least from European data, is considered to be about almost 3 or 2.79. You know, a lot of this depends on factors involved in the virus itself, the host, and community situations. But it also informs us as far as what we need to do as a population to have immunity in order to allow people to return to work. So let me discuss that in the context of how we determine that. So we know the cases, we know people who get sick, we know the number of deaths. So the number of deaths is something that's a given. You can't fudge that number. We know who dies. We don't know the total number of cases. So if you look at the tenfold increase in cases based on projections, case fatality rates are probably under 1%. But we, as I said, we know the people who are infected will develop immunity. We don't know how durable that immunity is. And this is something that we're looking to our colleagues in China and in Europe to help us with that. We know that with any infectious disease, the body mounts an antibody response, and that protects you from reinfection. How long that protection lasts, we don't know yet. But we do know that somebody who was infected, who recovers, is likely to be okay to go back to work, to go back into the community. And we're looking at something that we call an immunity passport, something that you can show proof of immunity either by way of having had documented infection or doing an antibody test, which is a blood test that shows that you have mounted antibodies if you were asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic. There's a version of this being employed in Wuhan right now on your cell phone. If you have a yellow light on the phone, you're free to do certain activities, green light, you can do anything. We may have something similar to this in the U.S., but we don't have the same sort of infrastructure here that would allow enforcement the way they do perhaps in China. So the antibody test, what we call an immunity passport, may be very helpful to allow people to go back to work, to start congregating, to go to shows, to restaurants, et cetera. This is something that as soon as we have good antibody testing, hopefully will be rolled out. Let me say a few words about treatment. We are very eager to start clinical trials, and some have already begun with a few different medications. The one that you've heard most about is hydroxychloroquine. It was actually our geocentral site in Marseille that first published data on hydroxychloroquine. It looks like a very promising medication if started early. This is a medication that's not for someone who's terribly sick. We feel that it helps reduce the virus prevents the virus from going from the upper respiratory airways into the lungs. It prevents binding to what's called the ACE2 cells of the lungs. So if hydroxychloroquine gets on board with it early, there's some evidence that it may actually mitigate the course of the disease. We're doing a clinical trial at prevention in healthcare workers. There are numerous other trials of hydroxychloroquine, either by itself or with azithromycin, being rolled out. Convalescent serum, the serum or blood of people who have recovered, as a way to get antibodies and deliver them to a sick person. There are trials ongoing with this. In other diseases, convalescent serum has been very effective. Remdesivir, you've heard of, it's an antiviral intravenous, so it's reserved for people in the hospital. Clinical trials are promising. And also BCG. BCG is a vaccine that's given in Europe. It's not given in the U.S. And elsewhere to prevent tuberculosis. There's some evidence that it has may have a beneficial effect on reducing the infection with COVID-19. So clinical trials, we're waiting for the results of these trials. There's some enthusiasm, particularly about hydroxychloroquine and perhaps convalescent serum. The antibody tests, as they roll out, and as we learn more about the immune response to this virus, we will be able to act on that. And just let me close with something which is a bit of a lighter note, I suppose, but you know, in terms of spread to animals, there was a case of coronavirus in a tiger at the Bronx Zoo, probably acquired by a zoo handler who is completely asymptomatic. We know that cats and tigers can contract this virus. Dogs apparently are do not. So, you know, just by way of saying, we're learning more about about transmission of the virus. This is a virus that probably started in the animal kingdom and jumped to humans. So there is a lot of work underway in the science of coronavirus COVID-19, and hopefully we'll see some short-term benefit and certainly long-term benefit from this. So I'll stop here and, you know, make myself available for questions. Thank you.
Well, one follow-up to what you were just saying. I mean, and we're about to turn now to the sort of the political responses in Washington and in Europe. And obviously, the balance beam that policymakers are walking right now is a real tightrope, to mix all my metaphors here. But basically, on the one hand, you know, they're trying to mitigate the fatalities and the overwhelming of the health system. And on the other hand, they are not trying to they're trying to not kill off their economies. And so we're seeing the staggered restarts of economies in Asia and possibly now in Europe. As this happens and as we start to contemplate that here in the U.S. as well, you know, what are the things that you're really watching for, or others in the healthcare field are really watching for, or are most concerned about, I guess, you know, as we contemplate restarting and attempting to not do so prematurely, but at the same time to mitigate the long-term effects on the economy?
No, I think you've raised a very, very good point. And part of the problem on the initial response was driven by the same concerns. You know, we don't want to shut the schools because where are the parents are going to have to stop working to take care of their kids. I mean, this was the rationale in New York, you know, when we knew that you needed to shut the schools. Having a sort of schizophrenic approach to this is not going to work. It hasn't worked so far. I'm all for, you know, mitigating and minimizing the risk to the economy. I think that's exceedingly important. You know, at the same time, I think we have to be mindful of the epicurve. And I think, you know, we could try some measures, as I mentioned before, with people who've recovered, with people who are proven to have immunity, have a gradual return to work in that way. But I would caution against opening the doors prematurely. What would happen there is you would begin to see a secondary peak, and then we'll be back where we were and probably even in a worse position. So I think this has to be guided by the mathematical modelers, the people who look at number of cases, the flattening of the curve and where that is. And I think, you know, as much as we, you know, people wonder why do we talk about these numbers so much, it's really one way to keep our hand on the pulse of this outbreak. Epidemiologists, you know, look at epicurves and look at where they're going. You know, we're encouraged by what we're seeing this week, even though 50% of the cases occurred in the last 9 days. Here in New York, the projections that we made, even locally at our hospital, are we're lower than the projections by, let's say, 200 bed admissions in the past 24 hours than where we should have been. But we have to have a very close watch on those numbers. We have to have a very gradual return to the workplace. And the problem with that is people are going to have a false sense of maybe have a false sense of security, be in denial to some extent. We have to be vigilant as we go through that phase. You know, the mistakes that we made so far, we cannot, you know, we cannot afford to repeat them going forward. So I think it has to be guided by science, not just wishful thinking.
So I want to turn attention now to what's happening in Washington. And of course, one of the bits of context here, in addition to the what we've just described as far as the outbreak is concerned and the jobless numbers that just dropped a few minutes ago, you know, the latest polling data suggests that that the administration, the approval of the administration's handling of this has started to decline again. Approval rating for Congress is lower yet again. Governors, on the other hand, tend to be doing relatively well in terms of the public's perception of their handling. Tony, let me start with you as far as the implementation of the phase three fiscal deal is concerned. We've now had a week plus of trying to get this underway. We've heard varying stories from both from the highest level where, you know, some airlines are frustrated by the process and and facing bureaucratic hurdles past the deadlines. I really would like you to focus as well on the SBA front. The Paycheck Protection Program has gotten a lot of interest, obviously, but that has also led to bureaucratic problems, as well as banks being so sort of caught up in the onerous sort of know your customer rules, in a sense that that they may be limiting their work with pre-existing customers and the like. What are you hearing, and what's your sense of the administration's handling of this at this point?
Thanks, Kevin, and good morning, everybody. So let's put this in the perspective of about 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago tomorrow, phase three passed with overwhelming bipartisan support in Congress, which is a tribute to how seriously everybody is taking this moment. A lot of burden in that legislation was placed on the Treasury Department to really create an infrastructure that really had not been prepared before this crisis to do what it was designed to do, which is to flood the market with liquidity. And the first phase of that was this SBA Paycheck Protection Program of close to $400 billion. Anyone who had dealt with the federal government knows, that's a lot of money, and that's also a lot of money to try to create a vehicle to administer in less than a week. And that was the mandate that was given to Treasury. It rolled out last Friday with some kinks, admittedly. I think they'll own that as well. But for the most, there was some miscommunication or just maybe lack of agreement initially with some of the lending, private sector lending authorities and the banks on some of the rules. Nonetheless, they plowed forward with it. And look, I think the administration will say it wasn't perfect, but they had no choice, and you can't make perfect the enemy of the good. Something you've heard often, I think, from both sides while putting together solutions during this very precarious economic as well as public health time. So I think what you're seeing now is it's beginning to move a little bit more as it was planned, although there still are admitted kinks, though billions of dollars are being sent out through the banks to a lot of the businesses who qualify under 500 employees who are going to use the money for payroll and operating costs. There's a renewed, and I know Orson will touch on this certainly in discussing what's happening on the congressional side, but there's a renewed focus that the White House and Republicans certainly want to see another, $250 billion added to this Paycheck Protection Program. And there's some disagreement as to should it be part of a bigger package or just a standalone. That's a congressional fight that's probably about to happen. Nonetheless, there is some recognition that more money should be invested into it. The second part, though, that's not getting as much attention, but that's a massive, massive lending vehicle, is the Treasury Fed lending authority that is going to have rules, I believe, released and guidance released this week. Which is really targeted more toward medium-sized businesses. And there is going to be similar criteria, as I think you saw on the SBA side. But again, you're talking now about businesses over 500 employees that are going to be able to qualify for these types of loans and investments. This all goes toward, I think, the broader goal of the administration and focus of the administration, as you've been seeing, Kevin, and I think has been alluded to already on the call, which is the idea of when can you responsibly reopen the American economy? And there's going to be an announcement today, if not this week, of another sort of task force that's going to focus on economic recovery, chaired by the new White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, that's going to have on it all the economic principles inside the administration, as well as, I believe, some private sector individuals who will help advise a responsible way forward in opening up the American economy and focusing on the American comeback after we've stabilized obviously, the impact this public health crisis has had on the American economy. You know, you hear various ways they're thinking about it. I think the most consistent thing I've heard is it's a phased-in opening. They're going to start looking around the world to see some of the best practices and try to model those. But the idea being, based on the region of the country, the percentage and ratio of outbreaks and containment, and also in assessing specific individual sectors, they're going to start phasing in a reopening of the economy. And I know that the president certainly would like to see it sooner than later, but there is a lot of understanding that you have to continue vigilance. And I think he is going to continue to follow the guidance of some of the public health advisors he has with him. But I do think that there is more of an eye toward trying to reopen the economy probably in the next month. So those are the type of, I think, conversations being had in the White House. There's a few other smaller aspects that I still think are important that deserve mention, and then I'll turn it back to you, Kevin. For those of you on the call who were ever concerned or had an eye about the affiliate guidance, so this is basically about companies that private equity firms or venture capital firms are invested in, and do they qualify for the SBA loan program? And there had been a lot of ambiguity around that. Initially, the answer was no, they don't. But Treasury has cleared up this guidance and said if you have 51% control of your company or control of your board, even if you have a minority ownership of your company, you still can qualify for these SBA programs. The last thing I will mention, and this goes toward the reopening of the economy, you saw CDC last night put out guidance for critical workforces. And basically, this gives the clarity of if you are in a facility where there have been confirmed cases of COVID among your coworkers, you still can go work in that facility so long as, you know, you take your temperature and you don't show fever, and that you wear a face mask for 2 weeks. So that's, people are believing all that guidance is moving toward how do we get back to some level of normal functioning in our economy. So thanks, Jeff.
Can I just go back for one moment to you talked about this, the formation of the second coronavirus task force that's going to be headed up by the chief of staff, the new chief of staff, Meadows, and that's going to be focused more on the economic restart. And I'm wondering why there is a separate task force rather than housed with it. I mean, and I note, of course, that Dr. Fauci on NBC this morning has now indicated that the U.S. fatalities could be as low as 60,000, which is a horrendous number, obviously, but is a fraction of what some of the earlier projections were. But can you give us a little insight into what you're hearing out of the White House in terms of this, you know, of this balance, right? And are they putting the economic advisors sort of in competition, in a sense, for the president's attention with the scientific advisors by separating these two task forces?
No. In fact, I would say it's actually very responsible for them to bifurcate how they review both issues. And I'll tell you, having run two White House teams on two major issues in my time at both Treasury and the White House, you know, there's a massive interagency coordination that has to happen. And that's what you're seeing in the coronavirus task force marshaling for the public health side. But on the economic side, you have to remember, you have Treasury, you have the National Economic Council, you know, you have the Council of Economic Advisors, you have the Office of Management and Budget, you have labor, you know, you have all these departments, commerce, that have a role in preparing and planning and architecting the recovery. So instead of bogging it down in one massive task force, it's smart to bifurcate it, allow those principals to then focus in those work streams in a separate entity, and then that entity as well develops larger and gets external input from various market participants, stakeholders, business leaders, you know, people who are understanding what's happening in the outside real, quote, real economy. I think this was something that will soon, in fact, I think if you talk to people in the White House, there's actually a hope that people consider this completely separate from the existing coronavirus task force. They'd like to think of this as being much more forward-looking, focused on the comeback. And, you know, Kev, you started with, you know, the president's approval rating, et cetera. Look, obviously, anyone who knows the president, and it's kind of intuitive. Everybody likes to have good poll numbers. But I think the White House largely realizes you have to win the war. and you might lose a battle here and a battle there, but you got to win the war. And the way you win the war is to make sure this American economy comes back as quickly as possible. And they're putting all the conditions in place to lead to that.
So given that, let's move to the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue then, Orson. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about what's going to come next. Speaker Pelosi and Minority Leader Schumer issued a statement, you know, urging Congress to provide additional relief for small businesses and families. Tony's already alluded to the need to kind of reload the Paycheck Protection Program. There's been so much overwhelming interest in it, irrespective of any bureaucratic hurdles to the disbursement of funds. But what are you hearing, and what are your thinking right now in terms of what comes next from the congressional side?
Sure. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon to all. I'll start where I started last week, and I think it's the most important thing to remember as we do these calls is in D.C., everything is political, and there's 208 days until these members of Congress are on the ballot, and we have a presidential election coming up. So, you know, people are trying to be as bipartisan as they can be and addressing immediate fix, but ultimately every decision in D.C. is made through a political lens. And politics haven't stopped. Even though the virus has continued to take its toll, you still, you know, saw yesterday Bernie Sanders drop out of the race, which may have been in part to what happened in my home state of Wisconsin, watching voters stand in line. I think what you saw in Wisconsin is a pretty good litmus test of what will be debated in the halls of Congress on how to fund the election through potentially ballots or to make it easier for people not to go to the polls, particularly seniors. And then you've also seen activity on postponing the convention. So, you know, Congress is on recess. Politics is still as lively as ever. Last week, Speaker Pelosi indicated that she was going to roll out a stimulus package focused on infrastructure on Friday, rightly. I think she decided that maybe it now is not the time, and said that she would support, you know, any supplemental measures to address the previous bill. So with that, McConnell rolled out, as Tony alluded to, a $251 billion supplemental for the employee buyback program. Following that, Speaker Pelosi and Senator Schumer immediately rolled out that they were supportive of the supplemental, but thought that they too should press upon things that their constituents were pushing for through an emergency lens, such as, you know, additional funds for hospitals, additional funds for state and local governments, additional funds for food stamp recipients, and a more dedicated program to minority businesses that have been impacted in a lot of the target communities. So their package, along with the $251 billion, almost doubles. Both sides had hope to move on a potential piece of legislation in the Senate today. I know Senator McConnell and Schumer and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin have been meeting throughout the evening and this morning trying to reach a compromise. Hopefully they will. Nancy Pelosi has come out fairly strong this morning saying that if the current bill does not address some of, or if not all of, the provisions they would like to add. There's no way that she could get this through Congress through a voice vote, and there would be a high probability that, you know, people would probably reject it as is, and, you know, it may be stalled. So all that to say is I think, you know, look for a compromise to be reached in order for Congress to move this through. The thing I think both sides are trying to do is to keep their members home and to make this pill as easy to swallow as possible. If members come in, the harder it gets, the more partisan the discussion is, which I think will kind of take over the next phase of the phase five discussions. So if the Speaker, Speaker Pelosi, Schumer, McConnell, and the administration is unable to reach a compromise today, it may go into the weekend. I doubt it, but look for, you know, some kind of announcement by mid-afternoon. I think all this is kind of pointing to how hard this is for members to pass these, you know, $250 billion or half a trillion dollar packages without congressional debate, how hard it is for these political leaders to rally their members to be supportive and not be able to come in to voice a vote on it. And then, you know, Congress is supposed to return in a couple of weeks. The news is in D.C. is, you know, the pandemic is heading towards the D.C. area within the next week or so. It should reach its peak is about when Congress is supposed to return. So there's a lot of discussion on even if when the recess is over, members will be able to return. And more importantly, we'll have the ability to have an earnest debate on the next stimulus package. So, you know, I think, you know, as Tony alluded to, that the shifting discussions in D.C. will be the upcoming package. You know, how do you add some of the things that were discussed in the infrastructure bill into the next wave? Potentially, you'll see a lot of talk on expanding support for easy-to-bill items like technology that doesn't necessarily need state funds to offset. And then I also think, you know, the hot political discussion will be, you know, what comes out of this task force. A lot of governors, of course, will push back on when do you restart the economy. You know, this discussion will, you know, will not be limited to the Beltway. A lot of state and local and congressional leaders will have a strong point of view on it. So, you know, those will be fought through the airwaves. But, you know, it will be very interesting to see what happens today on how we reach a compromise. I think they all agree that this supplemental needs to be passed. But I think it really forces Congress, which is a positive thing, to roll up their sleeves, to find compromise and provide solutions to people who need them most.
Yeah, thanks, Orson. I want to turn our attention here a little bit to Europe because you know it's easy, you know, listening to all of the detail that that Orson and Tony have gone through to get very necessarily focused on the U.S. But Europe has really seen obviously the brunt of this outbreak. Certainly in terms of the fatalities as we've spoken about earlier. And clearly, we've seen a bit of everything in Europe, from overwhelmed healthcare systems in Italy and Spain to countries that got look like they got ahead of this pretty well in Germany, to countries that aren't really doing much of anything at all, relatively speaking, like Sweden. We've got a prime minister who is in the intensive care unit in the United Kingdom. Orson, tell us what's going on in Europe, and particularly, I would like you to focus, if you could. I know it's a small market. But Austria, as well as I think Denmark and Norway, starting to talk about their economic restarts. And what that actually really means. It certainly doesn't appear to be an all-out green light. What are you seeing and what are we looking for? And how would you characterize the overall kind of response? At the moment, the European Union seems like it's a bunch of countries that just happen to be connected with one central bank, but other than that, are operating in a pretty disparate manner.
Yeah, Kevin, I think that's a fair assessment overall, unfortunately. But the Austrian case and the question of the lockdown exit, I think that's definitely a very very interesting factor to look at right now, given where we are here in Europe. We have Austria, we have Denmark, Norway, the Czech Republic as well, which we see under this headline of restrictive measures coming to an end. But if you look at the substance of that, I think that gives you a better idea of the fact that this is a very gradual process that will probably take months and months. So if you look at Austria, for instance, exiting the lockdown means, you know, an extended ban on public events that takes you through to the end of June, for instance. It means new requirements such as the need to wear face masks if you want to use public transport. And only under that condition, the government has said, perhaps we will be at the point in mid-April where we can allow smaller shops to reopen again with social distancing measures still in place, i.e., the number of people who will be allowed into those shops and so on, still extremely, extremely limited. To your point regarding overall European coordination, the Commission in Brussels obviously is always very keen on that. And I think it was a very telling incident a couple of days ago that the Commission wanted to go ahead with a roadmap plan towards exiting lockdown measures across Europe. And within a couple of hours of those news coming out, you had several member states' capitals calling up Brussels and telling them, you're not going to publish that. We will keep this under national control, and we certainly don't want to send that signal to our home populations right now that a real exit from the lockdown is ahead. So this is going to be a very gradual process. Maybe an interesting question that clients have raised and that I think has already been raised also on this call here today is, you know, how political is this? How ideological is this? What drives government decision making? And I think if you look at three of those countries that have moved ahead here, Austria, Czech Republic, Denmark, you see that in terms of government composition, you have a center-right government together with the Greens in Austria, rightist populists in power in the Czech Republic, and a social democratic minority government in Denmark. So you see all sorts of political parties in power who overall, however, end up choosing a very gradual exit from those restrictive measures. So I think that is a positive sign because it suggests that across the board, these governments are listening to the experts and are taking a very, very careful approach. But I think that does, at the same time, it's important to highlight that this does not mean that no politics is involved. I think the politics that will matter here going forward over the next couple of months is the politics of institutional capability and institutional capacity. So not so much in terms of immediate crisis response, you know, how many ICU beds can you add? Do you have an army or a national guard that you can use that can help? How long does it take you to construct a makeshift hospital? All these immediate crisis measures, but more these kind of longer term questions. Some of these aspects have already been mentioned on the call. What is your ability to roll out a testing system for a prolonged period of time? What is your ability to provide something like contact tracing with all the difficult political questions that this obviously raises in Europe with a view to privacy, supervision, and so on? What about the provision of protective equipment, perhaps your ability to manufacture that at home? So all of these, the capability to provide for this, that those are deeply political questions. And I think what we see is that those countries who are moving ahead with this very careful exit strategy right now, those are countries that have been extremely strict in the beginning and that across the board perhaps do have the political capacity that makes them so confident that they do think that they have this capacity for these longer-term monitoring tools and so on going forward. We certainly don't have this in place everywhere in Europe, and I think that institutional capacity, the politics behind that, will be a huge differentiating factor over the coming months.
Kevin?
Sorry, I was just on mute. I just wanted to turn for a moment to the United Kingdom, where Prime Minister Johnson remains in the ICU. And I know that they've got some significant decisions upcoming with regards to the state of lockdown in the UK, et cetera. Is the decision-making ability of the cabinet compromised at all with the prime minister being essentially out of commission, or how does that work?
I think the key point to look at here is the fact that compared to some of these other countries, for instance, Austria, the UK still seems to be at a different point in time regarding the outbreak of the disease. And I think that realistically limits the options that are, you know, in fact and really available to political decision makers. So politically, it's obviously, it's a complicated situation, especially under the British Constitution, where you don't have, you know, like in the American case, a vice president who could take over. That is not so clearly regulated under the Constitution here. But the reality is that the decision whether to extend the lockdown comes up between Monday and Thursday at the latest next week. I think given the numbers that we're still seeing here in the UK, the problems that we've seen also with rolling out some of these testing capacities and so on, I think realistically there is no alternative to extending that lockdown for now. So to me, the question would be more politically charged, more politically interesting and problematic in a situation where you're actually facing real alternatives. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem that the UK will reach that point within the next couple of days.
So in a few minutes, we're going to get to people's questions, but I want to get to where the rubber really hits the road now for our clients, which is how corporations, you know, tactically and strategically address what they are dealing with. And Christian, thank you again for joining us from the West Coast. I could have let you sleep in for another half hour, I guess, but we're in earnings season here in very special circumstances, obviously. So, in your view and how you're advising clients, I mean, what should investor relations teams be considering here in terms of transparency and messaging, in terms of preparation and the format for their earnings calls? And I think maybe extremely importantly, what are the big risk factors that you're thinking that they should look to avoid this earnings season?
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. The most important consideration is really that the scope of what constitutes relevant communication is larger today than it has ever been. Messaging for earnings will need to consider a broader range of stakeholder groups than ever before. Customers and the public at large are looking to companies to provide guidance. Employees need reassurance. Government officials are looking closely at how companies are responding to this crisis. Investors and debt holders need to be considered. Partners within the organization and partner organizations that companies are working with need to be considered. This means bringing in government affairs teams, human resources, treasury, ESG teams, sales leaders early in the earnings creation process to ensure that the right information is brought to the forefront. This is going to place a unique pressure on IR teams and senior leadership, who will have to find new ways to build consensus internally to ensure that these groups are considered and addressed in an efficient way on time-constrained earnings calls. Considering messaging and priorities more broadly is not just important for those stakeholder groups, it's also important because large institutional investors, ratings agencies, and the SEC are looking beyond the financials this quarter. BlackRock recently commented that it would not be easing up on its sustainability priorities this proxy season. A group of over 200 institutional investors published a set of expectations of all companies during the crisis, including fair treatment of employees and limits on executive compensation. And Glass Lewis has come out and said that all governance issues are going to be impacted and is saying that there's no better way to observe the effectiveness of governance than in a crisis. Now, when it comes to investors and debt holders, what I would say is that uncertainty is the single biggest impediment to investment in the current environment. It is skewing investment decisions. It is leading to dislocation across debt and equity markets. To address that, demonstrating a commitment to transparency throughout this crisis and ensuring regular and consistent engagement with investors even when the solutions are still unknown, will be critical to stabilizing markets and supporting valuation in the weeks ahead. As plans develop, we think investor relations teams need to consider implications for investor engagement and whether stepped up IR team or executive engagement is warranted when the impulse may be to restrict and hold back on engagement. In many cases, we think outreach through virtual equity conferences, special calls, or NDRs may prove advantageous. Holding modeling calls following an earnings call may be appropriate. Where we've seen these type of engagements already, they've been well received by the investment community, even in challenged industries. Ultimately, we think creating stability in markets will really require a comprehensive program across industries and companies to reassure the investment community and the public with concise messaging focused on three key areas of concern. First, supply and demand. Investors are unsure as to what the underlying demand environment and the supply environment looks like today, not to mention what it will look like in 4, 8, or 12 weeks' time. Providing any visibility into the slope of the demand and supply curves is job one for executives when engaging with the financial community. Providing even a modicum of visibility will help avoid a skew to the worst case scenario, which is already where investors are. On the cost side, it is no secret that the demand environment is declining rapidly across most industries. Finding clear ways to identify cost containment options in the face of double-digit or worse declines in demands is critical. That will allow investors to successfully evaluate downside risk, create pricing floors for their investments, and create the conditions by which value-driven actors will be able to step into markets. The third piece is on capital. Investors are deeply concerned that debt markets are exhibiting signs of stress and are increasingly worried that liquidity-enhancing initiatives may become more challenging. The Fed is helping by reintroducing commercial paper funding facilities and offering unlimited quantitative easing, but liquidity remains at the forefront of investor concern. To that end, we are seeing preemptive actions to enhance liquidity, including revolver drawdown, suspension of shareholder return programs, tapping of additional liquidity wherever possible. We think that has to be considered in this environment and disclosed frequently and often, even for companies that are well capitalized and cash rich. When it comes to the risk factors, going back to the earlier statement, I think the first risk is really not considering all of the relevant stakeholders on the call. Beyond this overpromising, there's really asymmetry of risk when it comes to guidance. The downside risk of providing guidance or targets that later need to be revised is really a loss of credibility, a reiteration of uncertainty right at the moment when investors are looking to find their feet. The upside to providing more robust or more positive guidance than what actually ends up happening is near-term stock support driven, frankly, by arbitrage of short-term focused investors. And that is a zero-sum game as far as I'm concerned.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Christian. And we do have a few minutes here that I'd like to address questions. So, David, if you could please instruct the audience how to get into the queue.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, the floor is open for your questions. If you would like to ask a question, you may do so now by pressing star 1. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 now. It appears at this time we have no questioners in the queue.
Let's give it another minute here, David. But Christian, let me just follow up with you on one other point. How should companies, on the earnings calls, how should they handle questions about the big macro picture? You know, whether it is, economic forecasting, or, you know, some of the other big picture elements we've talked about earlier in the call, or even more speculatively, you know, the sort of what is the world going to look like for your industry on the other side of this thing?
You know, I would argue that very few companies have the visibility at this moment to be able to carry the weight of providing visibility into the macroeconomic environment and where it's going. What the timing of impact looks like, what the slope of recovery looks like, those are big questions that it really remains incredibly challenging to answer. Now, we have seen some companies provide scenarios that lay out several options for how they are considering recovery, and that's been very well received. I would call out IHS Markit, which has done this incredibly effectively, laying out earnings expectations for a 3Q, 4Q, and 2021 recovery. None of those scenarios has been established as their framework, as the rule of law for what they're going to be delivering, but it's helped create an understanding of what the dynamics are under their control with respect to earnings and cash flow generation. This is not just limited to industries that are seeing relatively stable demand. Even Marriott and Uber, two highly affected companies, have attempted to bracket the risk on special calls by providing visibility into the scenarios that they're considering. I would also call out that I think, you know, there is an exception to this guidance, which is that in industries that are seeing heightened demand, I think there's an opportunity to reiterate commitments to investment, not just in employees, but in willingness to commit capital to ensure that the economy keeps moving. And I think those industries have, in some senses, an obligation to demonstrate a willingness to support the continued functioning of the economy. You know, I will say in all of this, considering macroeconomic projections, becoming the voice of the economy adds significant risk and will likely dilute take-up of other messages by the public and the financial media. So it really has to be considered very carefully.
Great. Thank you. And Dr. Connor, I wanted to turn to you for one last question here, because there's increasing concern, obviously, about the developing world, not only because of their populations, but also their capacities with which to test and to deal with the outbreak. And I do think that next week in particular, or in the next week or so, we're going to get renewed attention also on things like debt sustainability and the like as we head into the IMF World Bank spring meetings. What are you watching for or most concerned about, or what are you seeing on the emerging market front, particularly as we head into the fall and winter in the Southern Hemisphere?
No, that's a very good point. You know, very little of our attention has been paid to the developing world, and we're quite concerned as this virus spreads to the Southern Hemisphere in particular, that the healthcare infrastructure ability to test, ability to contain is going to be very, very limited. So there may be a second wave of this in the developing world that will be even more difficult to contain. That's not good news for us because, you know, something that happens anywhere happens everywhere. And, you know, those of us who are looking at developing countries have some concerns. There's already sort of a plan in place for, you know, healthcare assistance, containment assistance, but it's just now being developed. I think this is something you need to keep on your radar when you think about, you know, the way that we do containment may not translate to lesser developed economies, and you know, it's a reason to be concerned.
Great, thank you, and we will pay greater attention to this on one of our future calls. I'm aware it's the bottom of the hour. I want to thank everybody for joining us today, and particularly our guests and speakers, Dr. Bradley Connor, Orson Porter and Tony Sayegh, Karsten Nickel, and Christian Buss. If you do indeed have a question, please don't hesitate to reach out at TeneoInsights@Teneo.com or reach out directly to your Teneo contact. And again, we will be back next week with another edition of this coronavirus conference call for Teneo Insights. Thank you again for joining us, and have a good holiday weekend. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the Teneo Insights conference. You may disconnect your phone lines, and thank you for joining us this morning.